Ambassador Susan Rice. Susan Rice's new memoir, Tough Love, is a candid and fascinating reflection on what it's like to negotiate with world leaders and take part in complex foreign policy decisions at the highest levels, all while being a mother, daughter, and wife. During the Clinton administration, Rice was a member of the National Security Council and then served as senior advisor for African affairs. During the Obama administration, she was first U.S. ambassador to the United Nations and then national security advisor. She helped craft policy on every major foreign policy decision of the Obama administration. Susan Rice has deep family connections to Maine and at one point suggested she might run for U.S. Senate, challenging Senator Collins. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Next on Maine Calling, Ambassador Susan Rice. First, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Susan Rice has been very much in the news these days. Of course, she has a new memoir out, and with all that's going on in the world, her experience at the top levels of policymaking have made her a much sought-after voice. Today, she's in Maine and here in our studio. Ambassador Rice's memoir is Tough Love, My Story of the Things Worth Fighting For. And as always, we want to hear from you. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Ambassador Susan Rice, what a treat to have you here in our studio today.
It's great to be back in Maine and great to be with you. Thank you.
Susan, you have family connections to Maine, and I saw that on Twitter you referred to Maine as your second home. Your mom grew up in Portland. Tell me about her, your grandparents, and your relationship to our state.
Well, thank you. My family ties in Maine go back over 100 years. My grandparents, Mary and David Dixon, came to Portland in 1912 as immigrants from Jamaica at a time when, as you can imagine, there were very few people of color in Maine. And they had no education to speak of. My grandfather was a janitor. My grandmother was a maid. And they came, like so many immigrants, in pursuit of the American dream. They raised their family in a home on Munjoy Hill on Lafayette Street. They had five children, and they saved and worked very hard to send all five of their kids to college. My four uncles all attended Bowdoin College, and my grandfather was reportedly the first man to have four sons attend Bowdoin. My uncles, two of them became doctors, one an optometrist, one a university president, and then along came my mother, the youngest, 11 years behind her next oldest brother. Mom grew up also in Portland, attended Portland High School, was valedictorian of the class of 1950, and went on to Radcliffe College after having had difficulty obtaining the financial assistance that she needed to get to Radcliffe. She was denied a scholarship by the Maine State Radcliffe Committee because she was black, and they viewed her as unable to come back from college and move in what they called the proper circles. So having been denied by Radcliffe, the principal at Portland High School and her debate coach, my mom was also a champion debater, appealed directly to Radcliffe and to another organization to give my mother the money that she needed to go to Radcliffe. And they did, and she was able to, where she was president of the school and a very successful student. And she went on to devote most of her career to trying to increase access to higher education, to colleges and universities for Americans. She was known as the mother of the Pell Grant, which has enabled 80 million Americans to attend college. So Mom has deep ties to Maine. I grew up coming here every summer, visiting my grandparents, hanging out with my cousins. When my mom reached close to her retirement age in the early 1990s, she definitely wanted to come back to Maine, and she bought a home in Lincolnville Beach. And that home has also been my home and still is since my mother passed in 2017. So my brother and I still feel like this is a very important place for me and our family. Our kids have grown up here as well, spent summers here. My daughter goes to camp here. So it's really, it is as close of a place as I have to a second home.
After the Brett Kavanaugh hearings, you hinted you might run for U.S. Senate from Maine. How seriously did you consider it?
I did consider it. I admit that I tweeted that rather spontaneously. I was quite disappointed and disturbed by her decision to support Kavanaugh when her vote was so instrumental in ensuring his ascent to the court. I did think about it quite a bit. I did some homework and did some consulting. But the main thing I needed to do and did do, which was to consult with my family. And I have one child in college and one still in high school who's now an 11th grader. And after my husband and I really worked through the implications of moving her out of school at that crucial stage and up here, we really thought this wasn't the right time. And frankly, having spent 8 years of her life, 4.5 away from her in New York when I was UN ambassador, and then another 3.5 under the same roof but not very available as national security advisor, I really thought this was not the time to put a further stress on the family.
You said not the time. Will you perhaps run in the future?
I might.
You're back in the news cycle right now after referring to Senator Lindsey Graham as a piece of excrement. Would you care to expound?
I don't care to expound. I think the statement speaks for itself.
Well,
but I will tell you what prompted that. I was on a podcast, Pod Save America, with two colleagues from the Obama administration with whom I had gone through the experience of Benghazi. And they raised Lindsey Graham, and they began a sentence that was leading to that conclusion, and I finished it. And quite honestly, you know, that's not language I typically use in public, and my mother would be very frustrated and angry with me right now. But the truth is, Lindsey Graham has been attacking me and my integrity for over 7 years, and I've kept my mouth shut. And he's called me incompetent, untrustworthy, a liar, the list goes on. And, you know, as Lindsey Graham's own behavior has become more and more reprehensible, including defending comments like the president's comment on lynching and many other things, I let my frustration out. He is, of course, predictably responded in kind on Twitter. And so Lindsey's attacks on me continue. I finally had my say.
And if one reads your book, they will understand
why.
Why?
Yes.
Seriously, you've played a critical role in so many foreign policy decisions during both the Clinton administration and Obama administration. And so much has played out in the 30-some months since you left your post as National Security Advisor. Let's talk about Syria. You were in the room as decisions were made about when and what kind of U.S. intervention was appropriate. And in your book, you write, for 6 years, the Obama administration wrestled painfully and unsuccessfully with Syria, which I believe to be the hardest policy challenge we faced. Explain the thinking that went on over those months and years in this situation year. What was the calculation?
Well, I think it's important for viewers and listeners to understand that, you know, there are really three aspects to the decision-making process that we went through on Syria, or three critical decision points. One, which is probably the most infamous, was the question of whether the United States would respond with use of force following the chemical weapons attack in 2013.
The so-called red line. Yeah.
Yes. The second was the broader and ongoing question of the extent to which the United States should get involved directly, militarily, in the civil war on the side of the opposition against Assad. And the third was whether or not the U.S. should be involved in fighting ISIS. To make a long story short, President Obama had no doubt that we had to be involved in the fight against ISIS. That directly implicated our national security interests and that of our allies. And he worked to build a coalition of over 65 countries and to forge a relationship with the Kurds that put ISIS on the path to defeat in both Iraq and Syria. And that's really the issue that's in the news today as we're debating President Trump's decision. On the Syrian civil war, we agonized over this. This was really the crux of the hardest issue because the humanitarian and security implications of the civil conflict were so enormous. ultimately, President Obama decided that he did not think it was in our interest in the aggregate to put U.S. troops on the ground on the side of the opposition in the civil conflict, as we would be essentially replicating an intervention on the scale of Afghanistan or Iraq. And then on the chemical weapons question, I write about that because I actually recommended to the president and was the only one in his senior cabinet and national security team to recommend that he go ahead and strike in response to the use of chemical weapons, even without congressional authorization. President Obama decided that he thought it was important to get congressional authorization for reasons that I fully appreciate. I just thought he wasn't going to get it. It turns out I was right about the politics. He didn't get it. But I was wrong about the policy, in my estimation, because he was able instead to negotiate the removal of 1,300 metric tons of chemical weapons out of Syria, which otherwise wouldn't have gotten out, and the destruction of that 1,300 metric tons. If people question, you know, well, wasn't that a loss of credibility? Shouldn't we have done it? I think you can make arguments to that effect. But then President Trump, when chemical weapons were used again in 2017 and 2018, he took President Obama's strike list off the shelf and struck for about 12 hours each time. Nothing changed. Not a single metric ton of chemical weapons was identified, removed, and destroyed. We felt good at the time, you know, as Americans feeling like we finally did something. And I actually supported President Trump's decision to do that. But it didn't change anything. It just was a feel-good opportunity that didn't translate into any progress on the ground with respect to chemical weapons or diplomacy.
How about the more recent decision to pull U.S. troops?
I'm very concerned about that. As I've been saying publicly, I think it's a strategic catastrophe. I think it's incredibly telling that national security leaders and experts in both parties are despairing over the consequences of that decision. Essentially, what it has done is, one, take all the pressure off of ISIS, and enable ISIS prisoners to escape, enable cells to reconstitute. After a five-year effort to put ISIS on the path to defeat, they now have the opportunity to reconstitute. We sold out our Kurdish partners, who sacrificed over 11,000 lives to fight on our behalf and that of our partners against ISIS. They have now been cleansed, in effect, from the north of Syria, lost their traditional ethnic homeland, and we have blessed this as a good outcome when, in fact, you know, it's selling out a partner in the most extreme sense. And it sends a message to all of our allies and potential partners around the world that we can't be relied on to keep our faith. And finally, it's given Vladimir Putin, Assad, and Iran an extraordinary opening now to move into that third portion, one-third of Syria that they did not control, that includes the oil fields and includes the Kurdish homeland. And the big winners are those three, plus, of course, the Turks, who now have their cleansed zone along the Syrian border.
Is the U.S. ceding leadership in the world?
Well, I think I hate to say it, but yes, in a very stark way, in this, by virtue of this decision. I think we've been gradually ceding leadership through President Trump's denigration of our alliances, his lifting up of, you know, traditional adversaries and praising people like Putin and Kim Jong-un and Mohammed bin Salman and Saudi Arabia, now Erdogan in Turkey. You know, the string of lies that come out of the White House also undermine our credibility. So I think there are lots of things, our refusal to stand up for democracy and human rights as we would normally. All of these things have undermined our leadership in the world, but almost nothing as starkly as this decision in northern Syria, because it has accomplished so much for the negative so quickly and really ceded a strategic foothold to our most committed adversaries.
Trump administration has undone or pulled the U.S. out of several agreements that you worked really, really hard for, the TPP, the Paris Climate Change Accord, the Iran nuclear deal. What do you
Cuba
believe?
Cuba opening.
Oh, yes. And just this morning I read that the Cuban National Airlines is canceling a lot of flights to the U.S. Of all those things, what do you believe is the most significant?
I think the most irreparable and the most concerning is the Iran nuclear deal. and I'll come back and explain why, but we can get back into the Paris Climate Agreement. We can get back into the Trans-Pacific Partnership. We can, through executive authority and of a new leadership, change the nature of the relationship with Cuba back to something quite a bit closer to where it was at the end of the Obama administration. But with Iran, I don't think that that Humpty Dumpty can be put back together. We had a deal that had prevented Iran from acquiring a nuclear weapon in perpetuity with the most rigorous inspection regime ever established. Iran was adhering to that deal. Their adherence was validated by the U.S. intelligence community, by the Defense Department, by the United Nations. And we pulled out of it unilaterally and imposed crushing sanctions to punish them for adhering to a deal that the United States negotiated. In doing so, we left our European partners hanging, who had been very much invested in this, and also Russia and China, the other partners in the deal. Iran is a proud country and a proud people. Their pursuit of nuclear weapons was a significant security concern for the United States and our allies in the region. And now we've taken any restraint off of that. And we've seen, after a year of them withholding reaction, that they're now acting out in ways that are very dangerous, that could provoke a conflict either with Saudi Arabia or with the United States. And if we did that in order to put more pressure on Iran, it's had the opposite effect. They're acting out, and all of their bad behavior that the Trump administration was trying to change, as any administration would, their support for terrorism, their missile tests, their human rights record, none of that will be addressed by the decision to pull out of the nuclear deal. In fact, all those things are as bad or worse than they were, but we've lost the constraint that we had on their nuclear program.
One of the things that really struck me about your memoir, Susan Rice, is that Ambassador Rice, is that you, there's a great deal of candor, not only personally, but also about foreign policy decisions. I'm hoping later in this hour to get to some of those, personal revelations. But as far as foreign policy, if you could take a time machine back, what would you have done differently?
Over 25 years?
Let's just say 10.
Okay. I think I'll give you one that's in the present that concerns me greatly. In 2015, the Obama administration, and I was very much part of this decision, agreed to provide support and assistance to Saudi Arabia and the Saudi-led coalition as it fought Houthi rebels in Yemen. We did that because the Saudi Arabia is a traditional partner. They were facing attacks into their territory from Yemen, orchestrated by these Houthi elements, and we were trying to help them defend themselves. That original decision morphed into increased support, giving them aerial refueling, giving them weapons, giving them tactical intelligence and other stuff as they fought inside of Yemen. And the result has been the world's greatest humanitarian crisis, perpetrated by both sides, but substantially by the Saudi-led side, with U.S. support. We, at the end of the Obama administration, tried to ramp down that assistance, constrain it. We found that the Saudis didn't really care whether they were hitting civilian targets or not. And that worried us greatly, and it raised the specter of crimes against humanity, and we didn't want to be as engaged in that. But the Trump administration came in very closely tied to the Saudis and ramped up that support unconditionally. And so we continue to be complicit in the Yemen conflict, despite Congress voting in both houses and both parties to try to limit our involvement and roll it back. President Trump has not heeded those concerns. And, since it was a relationship and an engagement that began on our watch, I have to admit that I regret it enormously. And I would, if I could turn back time, that's something I'd change.
We are speaking with Ambassador Susan Rice here on Maine Calling. We need to take a quick break. When we come back, some of your comments and questions. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Maine Masonic Charitable Foundation. supporting Maine Public Radio's efforts to provide knowledge, wisdom, and entertainment to the people of Maine.
The opioid epidemic is costly. Drug makers and distributors are being sued over their role in the epidemic. They could end up paying out tens of billions of dollars.
They're big dollar amounts, but it's probably just a fraction of the true cost of the crisis.
I'm Elsa Chang, calculating the real costs of the opioid epidemic this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That's coming up today between 4 and 6:30 here on Maine Public Radio. Are you a regular listener to Morning Edition? When you miss it, do you wish there was some way you could still hear it, even if it's not on the radio? Well, now you can if you have an Alexa smart speaker. Just say, "Smart speaker, please play Morning Edition." Alexa will then ask you which station you want to hear, and you, of course, will say Maine Public Radio. And then Alexa will play back the last full hour of Morning Edition. So you can hear the most recent hour of Morning Edition with Erwin Gratz until 3 o'clock each afternoon. Now, at this point in time, this is only for Alexa smart speakers, but we'll let you know if Google Home learns how to do this. Thanks.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, former UN Ambassador Susan Rice is with me. Her new memoir is called Tough Love. For those in the Portland area, she will be speaking this evening at Port City Music Hall. Visit our website for ticket information. If you'd like to join the conversation today, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief and please brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. On the line with us now, a caller who will be familiar to regular Maine Calling listeners. Larry Pope is a former ambassador to Chad, served as a political advisor to General Anthony Zinni in Central Command, and was chargé d'affaires in Tripoli, Libya, after the Benghazi attacks. He is author of several books, the most recent, The Demilitarization of American Diplomacy, Two Cheers for Striped Pants. Hi, Larry. Welcome back.
Hi, Jennifer. Hi, Ambassador Rice.
Hi, Ambassador Pope. How are you?
Good. Thanks very much. Earlier in the conversation, you mentioned the Benghazi business. And since I was in Tripoli a month or so after the assassination of Chris Stevens and his colleagues, I just wanted to say from my perspective that, you know, you endured partisan political attacks for 3 years after that, you and Hillary Clinton. There was no basis for any of them. They were disgraceful, but I think they may have left a sense in the minds of some people that something wrong was done in Washington. And the truth is that is without any foundation. It's really a disservice to the memory of those brave men, Chris and his colleagues, to have politicized this tragedy in the way that was done.
Well, thank you for saying that. I really appreciate it. I couldn't agree more. There are two huge tragedies, in my estimation. I'd be interested in your judgment on the second one that came out of Benghazi. The first and foremost was obviously the loss of Ambassador Stevens and three other Americans, and that was horrific for all of us who served with them as colleagues, and, of course, for their families, and, frankly, for the people of Libya, for whom, as you know, Ambassador Stevens was really a hero. The second part of the tragedy, though, is I think it soured Washington, both the administration and Congress and public opinion, on the project of trying to help Libya reconstitute and build a more cohesive, unitary society after Gaddafi's removal. And, you know, I think, as I write in the book, Larry, I with some candor, you know, I think we squandered an opportunity to try to help Libya repair itself. I'm also candid in saying that, you know, I don't know that with the United States and the international community and the United Nations and Europeans, if we could have made a meaningful difference, yeah, given how fractured Libyan society is. But I regret that we were not as able, in part because of Benghazi, to focus as I wish we could have and tested that proposition.
Yeah. I agree with both those things. Let me just a brief story from the time when I was there that may illustrate what happened really in Washington. And it gets to a point that I want you to ask you to reflect on too about our national security institutions. It was about November of the fall of 2012, and I got word from a staffer at the National Security Council that we were going to have that the president was going to send a message to the then prime minister who had just been elected of Libya by the General National Conference, who's a fellow named Ali Saadat, and I was very pleased. And I said, well, you know, can I make this public? And the staffer who told me about the message said, well, you may want to read it first. And I got the message, and it was really very foolish indeed. It was a lecture to Zaidan, who had just taken over a government that was a fledgling government at best. And it said to him essentially, look, you need to reform your government and fix it and have a National Security Council. It's a lot more like ours. And second, don't expect us to pay for anything. Sincerely, Barack Obama. Well, I got the message, and it was really kind of a kiss-off in a way, and completely inappropriate. And so I called up the Assistant Secretary at the State Department, Beth Jones, whom I'm sure you know.
Sure.
And I said, Beth, where did this thing come from? And I used the same term that you used about Lindsey Graham, I'm afraid. And Beth said, I don't know. I haven't seen it. And says, I'll check around. And she did check around, and she was close to Hillary Clinton, and nobody at the State Department had seen the message. So, you know, it's a matter of regret to me that disciplined foreign service officer that I was, I sort of wrapped it in camouflaged it in what I thought was a pretty Delphic Arabic translation, and had somebody stick it under the door of the prime minister's office. And when I saw him a couple of times after that, he didn't refer to it, and I didn't refer to it, and needless to say, I didn't make it public. But that story is, to me, both an indication of the way in which the disaffection with Libya had poisoned the well in Washington, as you were suggesting, but also of the fact that the National Security Council staff, which you were not then in charge of, really didn't have any fundamental understanding of the situation there and had usurped in some ways the policymaking, you know, functions of the State Department. And I think I said in that little book that Jennifer referred to that's a continuing problem. And I wonder if you wouldn't mind reflecting on that from your perspective.
Yeah, no, thank you for that, Larry. First of all, the message obviously is unfortunate and inappropriate. And I'm disappointed to hear about it and that story. And I know how these things get written. You know, the staff will write the letter. The National Security Advisor presumably will read and approve it. And then it's sent to the president with a cover memo that explains the rationale for it. I don't know what the rationale for that would have been, particularly to the extent it was indelicately written. In a normal circumstance, presidential correspondence is usually drafted at the White House. But if things are working appropriately, they should be, you know, shared with and consulted through the State Department so that Assistant Secretary Jones or her team would not be unaware of it and not have an opportunity to comment on it, unless there was something, you know, particularly rare and sensitive about it, which it doesn't sound like there was. So that troubles me. But the larger the issue you raise about the relative role of the National Security Council and the State Department is, as you know, a larger and longer standing challenge. And I've worked, as you know, both as an assistant secretary at the State Department and at the NSC, and as a State Department employee, as UN ambassador. And I've worked at the staff level at the NSC early in my career, and then as National Security Advisor. So I've sort of seen this evolve over almost a 30-year time frame. And I think that, you know, there are many aspects to the challenge, but I think even I would agree that the National Security Council's role has grown increasingly expansive. And in the current context, it's not clear why, because there doesn't seem to be any national security decision-making process. But in more normal times, this is something that's evolved gradually from, you know, the Scowcroft era, where I think the NSC was the leanest and meanest, through Clinton, Bush, Obama, et cetera. And I do think that it's a challenge to be managed. I don't think the State Department or the Defense Department will ever always be happy with the National Security Council staff.
Mm-hmm.
But to be more transparent and more collegial and more coordinating than directive, I think is what we ought to strive for. I'm sure, you know, including under my tenure, there were many instances where folks at state felt that wasn't sufficiently the case. But I think it ought to be the objective. And when it's not the case, there ought to be good reason for it.
And the size of the staff is something that you tried to tackle.
Yeah, I did. My perspective on this may be a little bit in the weeds for most folks. But, you know, when I started as a junior NSC staffer in 1993 at age 28 at the White House under President Clinton, the NSC staff was policy staff was no, actually the whole staff was about 150. By the time I came in many years later, in 2013, as National Security Advisor, it was about 400. It had grown steadily over that period. In part, we folded in the Homeland Security Council, so that was an explanation. We had a larger economic policy staff. But I wanted to take my time as National Security Advisor, not make slash-and-burn cuts and not do things that would work to the detriment of our ability to serve the president. But after about a year and a half in the role, having really gotten a perspective on how things were working, I made a deliberate decision to gradually and thoughtfully rebalance and reduce the staff by about 15%. And we did it through attrition. We didn't, you know, throw anybody out the door. And we did it thoughtfully. There were some places where we needed more, some places where we needed less. I'm concerned, however, that the brand new fourth National Security Advisor under President Trump has apparently received presidential direction to slash the NSC staff. I never received presidential direction. This was my own judgment. And to do it very radically, quickly, and with a political agenda that concerns me, to get rid of the career staff that come from the agencies who are so talented and knowledgeable, and to pack it with political staff. And so I think how one does this is important, and why one does it is important. And you got to be thoughtful on both sides of the spectrum.
Larry, thank you so much for calling in today. That's Larry Pope, who called in, former U.S. ambassador to Chad. His most recent book is The Demilitarization of American Diplomacy, Two Cheers for Striped Pants. Ambassador Rice, I need to tell you, we have several posts with a similar theme. Scotty on Facebook, Susan Rice, please run against Susan Collins. And Nason, should your guest ever decide to run for senator from Maine, she has my vote. Thank you, Ambassador, for your lifetime of exemplary service.
Thank you.
We'll go to an email from Sam. How can the United States regain the trust of our allies after the Trump administration? How much do you think the current administration's vocal dissatisfaction with multilateral institutions, including the UN and NATO, has diminished our reputability on the world stage?
I think it's going to be difficult, but absolutely essential that we repair our relationships with our allies. We're going to need a president who understands that allies are force multipliers for the United States, that they make us stronger and more effective, and set out as a very early priority to reassure those allies and repair the damage, and also to reinvest in multilateral institutions. I think it's going to, you know, take, frankly, more than the good hard work of one future president, because the damage is quite lasting. Our allies are going to always, or at least for the foreseeable future, question if we can, again, at another election, whether, you know, near term or down the road, sort of abandon our international responsibilities and expectations and leave them flummoxed as to whether they can count on us.
Thank you, Sam, for that email. We are going to go to another quick break. When we come back, if you have questions for Ambassador Susan Rice, you can call our number 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet @MaineCalling, or post to our Facebook page.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from the First Church of Christ Scientist Portland, where you can hear about a new view of God and its effect on well-being tomorrow, October 25th at 7 p.m. On the next Speaking in Maine, an optimistic vision for a sustainable, wild, and socially just world.
So if we think about infrastructure, that is fundamental to a nation's development. What we have to say is, can we do infrastructure in a way that's better for local people and that's better for biodiversity?
E.J. Milner-Gulland is professor of biodiversity at the University of Oxford. She delivered this year's Mitchell Lecture on Sustainability at the University of Maine, Orono. We'll hear from her and Senator George Mitchell on Speaking in Maine, Thursday afternoon at 2 here on Maine Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, actress Catherine Hahn. She stars in the new HBO series Mrs. Fletcher, based on the bestseller by Tom Perata, about a divorced woman who has a confusing sexual reawakening after her son leaves home for college. Hahn is known for her roles in Transparent, Parks and Recreation, Bad Moms, and Private Life. Join us.
You can hear Fresh Air this evening at 7 here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, a conversation with former UN Ambassador and National Security Advisor Susan Rice. If you'd like to join our conversation, our phone number 1-800-399-3566. Joining us now, John Ochira, who is president of the South Sudanese Community of Maine. John, thank you for giving us a call. And I understand you'd like to share a little of your own story and ask Ambassador Rice a question. Please go ahead.
Yes, thank you. Ambassador Rice, thank you so much for your service to this country and your contribution to the world. Your role in the negotiations that led to the independence of South Sudan will never be forgotten by South Sudanese people around the world. My family and I managed to escape the war in South Sudan and lived in a refugee settlement camp in Uganda until 2005 when we immigrated to the States. Thanks to sensible people who are in government, including Catholic charities who made our journey possible. In 2011, when South Sudan became an independent nation, the South Sudanese population in diaspora and those at home thought that they were free at last. But knowing the events that unfolded shortly after independence and the current situation in South Sudan, do you think that the negotiation process and you as a key stakeholder put enough emphasis on preparing the government of South Sudan to build and protect institutions that sustain peace and stability in a new nation? Thank you.
Thank you, John. Thank you for sharing your story, and thank you for that important question. I just want to say how much I admire and respect the people of South Sudan, including the American community of South Sudanese. For people who haven't had the opportunity to visit South Sudan, I can't overstate how resilient and committed and worthy the people of South Sudan are of a functioning new country and the freedom and independence that they struggled so long to achieve. One of my greatest regrets and sadnesses, really not a regret, but more of a sadness, is that the newly independent state of South Sudan, which so many South Sudanese and many in this country worked hard to bring about, has been in effect almost stillborn. It has failed to achieve internal unity. It's been mired in conflict. It's suffering under corrupt and venal leadership, which is a huge regret. And the country has not been able to reap the benefits of its independence and its economic opportunity. And, I think U.S. actions and U.S. engagement from, frankly, the Bush administration through the Obama administration were appropriately directed at trying to bring about an effective, independent South Sudan. And I think the responsibility disproportionately for that failure lies with the leaders in the country particularly the president and the people around the president and the former opposition leader, Riek Machar. And it makes me very sad that people who deserve peace, freedom, and economic opportunity are suffering still.
John, thank you so much for calling in today. That's John Ochira, who's president of the South Sudanese Community of Maine. We're going to go to Constantino calling from Westbrook. Constantino, if you could be quick, that would be great. Lots of people want to call in and talk with Ambassador Rice.
Sure. Good afternoon to both of you. My question is a difficult one. And do you think, what is the possibility that Erdogan of Turkey will hold hostage the 50 or so nuclear tactical missiles that are at the Air Force base in Turkey?
Well, Constantino, I appreciate the question. And I have to say that as a former national security advisor, I'm really constrained about talking about any nuclear deployments anywhere in the world and can't, you know, confirm or deny your assertion. But I do recognize that, you know, we have a longstanding, very close military to military relationship with Turkey that relies on not only the basing arrangements and the opportunity to fly out of Incirlik in particular in order to deal with ISIS and other challenges in the region. And I think there's a risk, to answer the broader question, that as the events evolve, Russia gets closer to Turkey, Turkey continues to behave badly inside of Syria, that all aspects of our bilateral military relationship will come under greater strain, as they actually already have begun to, with Turkey throwing its lot in with Russia rather than with NATO on a critical air defense system.
All right, Constantino, thanks for your question. We'll go to Kathy calling from Waldo. Hi, Kathy, go ahead.
Good afternoon. I want to, can you hear me?
Yeah, are you on a speakerphone by chance, Kathy?
No.
Okay, go ahead.
I want to ask Susan Rice about the National Endowment for Democracy. Are you familiar with that organization, Ms. Rice?
Yes, I am.
Yes. Are you aware of its role in Hong Kong and Venezuela, and also that on the board of directors is John Bolton and Elliot Abrams?
I'm not following its activities at present closely, no.
Kathy, do you have a question that's not a yes or no question? Go ahead.
I want to know if you feel like the Democratic Party, specifically as it's active in the U.S. Congress, should investigate the role currently that is playing in Hong Kong and in Venezuela, because they have spent $1,357,974 on grants to organizations described as promoting freedom, democracy, and human rights in Hong Kong over the period from 2015 to 2018. Do you think that that needs to be investigated by Congress?
Well, again, I don't have the specifics on Hong Kong and Venezuela, but I know, generally speaking, the work of the National Endowment for Democracy, as well as the National Democratic Institute and the International Republican Institute, which have been pillars of U.S. efforts to encourage and sustain democracy in places where it's fragile, have done work that I'm proud of and that I think is worthwhile. I can't comment on every program and every dollar spent. And as I said, I can't comment on their present activities. But generally speaking, I have not seen out of either three of those institutions activity that concerns me.
Kathy, thanks for your call. We'll go to Susan calling from Freiburg. Hi, Susan. Go ahead.
Yes. Good afternoon, and thank you, Ambassador Rice, for your decades of public service and diplomatic and moral leadership. I had the privilege of working alongside U.S. Foreign Service persons when I worked for 15 years with refugees in Southeast Asia. And my question is actually regarding humanitarian disarmament, because that is what I've done for the past 25 years, including with the International Campaign to Ban Landmines, which won the Nobel Peace Prize. I would really like your reflections on two matters. One, why has the U.S. not joined the 1997 Anti-Personnel Mine Ban Treaty, even though we no longer use APMs, or the 2008 Convention banning cluster munitions? And two, just as important, what can be done to convince the U.S. government to call for or at least support negotiations on a preemptive ban on lethal autonomous weapon systems, also known as killer robots, as Nobel Peace Prize laureate Jody Williams and the Campaign to Stop Killer Robots urged at the UN on Monday?
Okay, Susan, thank you for your question.
Thank you, Susan. There's a lot in there, and I'm not sure I can do it all justice in the short time we have. But with respect to landmines, this was an issue that we took up actively in the Obama administration. And we did change U.S. policy with respect to anti-personnel landmines and evolved it into a policy that I think is far more suited to the realities of today and greatly reduced our reliance on landmines and the use of them. It's still an issue, however, that many in our Defense Department and our military feel we can't go as far as I think many policymakers, at least in the Obama administration, would have liked to have gone. And so while we made real progress, there's more that still can be done and I hope will be done. And I think similarly, cluster munitions, that is, in my estimation, far harder to defend. There's really no good reason for cluster munitions, and there's no good reason for the use of landmines anywhere anymore, except arguably, as the Pentagon would argue, on the Korean Peninsula. So I think on all these issues, including the last one that the caller raised, there's reason for fresh thinking about how we approach both the regulation and the employment of those weapons. And I don't think we're going to have any creative thinking on that in the near term in this administration. But I do hope that it's something that a new administration would take up with some urgency and seriousness.
Susan, thank you so much for your call. Ambassador Rice, we're, as you mentioned, short on time, and there's so much to talk to you about in your memoir. But one thing that was especially interesting to me was the story about when you found out about Ebola, the situation, the possibilities for stopping the spread. Many of the world events that you write about are things that really played out in the news, but there's a big part of this that did not. What happened when you found out first about this possible, terrible disease?
Well, it wasn't even possible. It was happening, right? People will recall in 2014, there was a major outbreak of Ebola in West Africa. And the director of the Centers for Disease Control came roaring into the White House Situation Room, into the senior cabinet level principals committee that I chaired as national security advisor, and put on the table a chart that showed that if things continued on the current course, within 3 months of September 2014, there would be 1.4 million people infected with Ebola, which has a mortality rate of 50 to 75%. That kind of explosion would not be contained in West Africa. It would become global. And so we mobilized very quickly under President Obama's leadership to bring all the countries that could contribute together to contribute under our leadership. He deployed 3,000 U.S. military personnel to support logistically the effort to bring in healthcare workers and save lives. And we did, rather than 1.4 million. There were over 11,000 who died, which is still an enormous number, but not nearly the kind of catastrophic pandemic that was possible.
And that was new thinking, wasn't it, to bring in the military to combat a disease?
Never been done before. And again, our servicemen and women weren't, out there, treating victims, but they were creating the infrastructure and the logistics support that enabled healthcare workers from Africa, the United States, and around the world to be able to do it.
And you're right. They came up with a plan in a day.
It was amazing. The U.S. military is the most capable organization on the planet, and when it wants to deploy and do good, there's nobody better. Whether it's to fight a humanitarian disaster, floods, earthquakes, or now we've learned healthcare, where it's critical and it affects global security.
All right. Well, finally, I want to ask, what would you say to those in our audience who are afraid right now, who see a fractured political scene and what seems like an increasingly destabilized world? There are a lot of people who are very anxious and very worried right now.
Well, I understand that worry. And I actually write about it in the last chapter of Tough Love. I have a chapter which brings together our national situation and, in fact, my personal situation. It's called Bridging the Divide. And it talks about the imperative that we heal our national political divisions, which I think at the moment constitute our greatest national security vulnerability. And I talk about how in our family we've wrestled with this. I have a conservative son and a progressive daughter, and we have all the spectrum represented under our family roof. And we've managed, despite those differences, not always easily, to remain a loving, cohesive family. That's what we have to figure out how to do on a national level. We have to figure out how to cooperate with and respect those with whom we differ. It also requires that we take, pretty dramatic steps to change the way our system is structured and not reward the political extremes. I think Maine has done something quite unique with ranked choice voting. It's one of the kinds of reforms that I think have the potential, when taken in the aggregate along with campaign finance reform and redistricting reform and all that sort of stuff, to change the nature of our political system. And then I also argue that we ought to consider more dramatic steps like mandatory national service for all Americans 18 to 22. Spend 6 to 12 months living, working, cooperating with people who come from radically different backgrounds. I think that's so important because it's very hard to hate somebody when you actually know them.
Ambassador Susan Rice, thank you so much for joining us today. The title of Susan Rice's new memoir is Tough Love. She will be speaking this evening at Port City Music Hall in conversation with Congresswoman Shelley Pingree. You can visit our website for information on tickets. Lucy Suchek ran the board today. You can find past editions of Maine Calling by visiting mainecalling.org. Today's show will be broadcast again tonight at 8. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.